Just a quick disclaimer. This is going to be a very code-heavy talk, but I guess here it's not really an issue. I sometimes do talk about more soft things, like teamwork and stuff like that, but today is going to be just very code-heavy. My name is Christian. I come from a company called Efficode, and I work as a technical agile coach. And not a lot of people know what that is, so I usually start by just breaking it down, also because it's very different from the title that's become pretty widely used of just agile coach. The technical part is actually very important. So I'm called a coach because I like working with people, both individually and as teams. Agile, obviously, this is very hard to see, but it's the picture from the Agile Manifesto website. I like the Agile Manifesto, and I especially like the principle that says we should have continuous attention to technical excellence. So I go and talk to different organizations and teams about how to do test automation, clean code, pair programming, software architecture, branching strategy, all of these very heavy technical practices, very close to the code and very developer heavy. And now you might be thinking, if I'm teaching test automation, why is the talk called Testless? And the thing is, I started my testing journey when I was at university, right? I learned about testing and I was like, this is going to be great, right? I loved it. Not only because there are like hundreds of ways to make CDD into like a drinking game, but also because I thought, this is awesome. I'll never have another bug, which was like, it's a huge deal, right? I'd already been coding for a long time and I've always been searching for this aesthetically perfect code, like code that doesn't have any errors at all. But spoiler alert, that's not quite how it went. In fact, it very quickly became a little bit difficult for me to work with testing. The first thing I ran into was how to actually test GUI. Like, that's not obvious how you can do something like that. Or something that's highly integrated, like how do we test complex systems? On top of the fact that it was very hard to actually do it right, it's also very easy to get it wrong. So there are three main categories that I see tests get wrong all the time. Like this one, for instance, doesn't test anything because if the inputs are equal, obviously the output's going to be equal. So that's nothing. Here we have something testing something that's actually not coded by us. There's a hash map or something like we don't. It's a third-party thing that we don't have control over. And the final category is when we test something that's essentially random, whether it will pass or not. In this case, inputting something into a database and then seeing that the created on date is today. And I literally had this in production at one of the customers I worked with, where it started failing at midnight, and then it was bells and alarms, and everybody should wake up, and something was wrong. And it turned out it used to run a little bit before midnight, so that then it was created on the same day, but because we just crossed midnight, it failed that one time. So it was basically random whether it would test or not, or at least it was very dependent on their surroundings. The testing foundation was further shaken when I learned that Jagstad had this wonderful quote where he says, tests can only prove the presence of bugs, not their absence. And I wasn't looking to find out if it had bugs. I know my code has bugs. I wanted to know it didn't have any bugs, right? That's what I'm going for. Sticking with it, I eventually hit the industry and I was like, okay, here must be where the white castle of testing is. But I was pretty much the only person at that party. Like, nobody was doing testing and I couldn't understand why. And so now that I've worked a lot in the industry and with a lot of different companies, I found out that the primary reason I see for people not doing testing is that it requires that we have a clean code base. But in order to get a clean code base, we need testing. And then we're sort of stuck, right? And it's an infinite loop. One way to say all of this or to sum it up is to say that testing is like an approximative approach. You can get infinitely good at it. It can get closer and closer to telling you what you want to know, but you will never be exact, right? It'll never be a photograph. And that some people like that. I'm more of an exact kind of person. I like having a real result with two lines under it and then I'm done. And so I started thinking, well, if testing has all of these problems, like it's difficult to master, it's easy to get wrong, we can't prove that it's correct, no one's doing it, and it requires a clean code base, why are we talking about it at all? Why does everybody know what testing is? And it's primarily because it's endorsed by some really, really smart people like Kent Beck and Robert C. Martin and Martin Fowler. In fact, where I work, we have a saying, you don't want to disagree with Martin Fowler because he's unlikely to be wrong. And so we generally follow that, but in this case, I started thinking about it, and I was like, well, if a lot of smart people succeed using some method, we can't actually really say anything about that method. They might just be smart enough to make it work. Sort of in a similar vein, if a lot of novices get something wrong, it's like it could just be because of inexperience. We can't really say anything. Where the interesting thing happens is if smart people tend to fail at something and if novices tend to succeed at something, that's where we can actually say something about the method. And of course, we need to take into account like statistical fluctuation. We need a lot of smart people and a lot of novices. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. I've seen a lot of smart people not be good at testing or not have testing work for them. And I've never seen a novice just succeed out of the gate with testing. So that tells me there might be something wrong with the method. This same argument also applies to Scrum, by the way, if any of you know that. So it's like, okay, so then maybe testing isn't the thing. So maybe we need something else instead to do the job of it. And before we can start searching for it, I wanted to figure out what am I actually looking for. I'm looking for quality. And quality typically comes in three categories, at least in the places that I talk about it. It can be fast, it can be secure, and it can be correct. And correct here means doing what the programmer intended. For me, first of all, security is also an approximative method. It's like you can get better and better, but then the attackers also get better, so it's kind of a race to the top. Also, speed is typically not important in the context that I talk about. It's not at least as important as correctness, because I don't care how fast you can give me a wrong result. I want the right result. And there's also some research showing that correct code or clean code bases are generally more secure than unclean code bases. So correctness is the thing I'm going to talk about and synonymize with quality in this talk. Then, if we want to eliminate all the errors and do what the programmer actually intended, we also need to categorize what are the types of errors we want to avoid. And there are also three. Three we could go for. The first one is programming errors. So when that's something like a null pointer exception or array index out of bounds, something like that. It could also be infrastructure errors where a file is missing or something around the code isn't good. A database is replying slowly or something like that. And it can be delivery errors. Those are like the customer doesn't get what they actually expected or what they wanted to get at least. Typically, the third category is solved by in a static environment by something like waterfall and in a dynamic environment by something like agile. And I know basically nothing about the middle category, so I'm not very good with databases or with connections and all of that networking stuff. But I'm pretty good at programming, so that's the subcategory of quality that I'm going to focus on, how we can actually improve that. How's the speed? Am I talking quick, slow? Good? Good? Okay. Cool. Before we get into the real weeds, I just want to define a couple of terms that I use a lot, but it's not necessarily common knowledge, I guess. Invariance is a word I use all the time. And it, for me, when I say it, it means something that we, the developer, knows, but the compiler doesn't know, right? It isn't aware of it. I'll get to a few examples in a second here. Then we have coupling, which is when code is shared between multiple teams. And if your team works as a bunch of individuals, then I would also consider each of them their own team. Like, then you have single person teams, and the coupling will be between those. Then we have fragility of a code base, which is when change in one place breaks something seemingly unrelated. And that happens all of the time due to the other two there. So here's a very, very small example. From here on, it's just going to be basically all code, or almost all code. In this case, these two lines both show invariance in coupling, which is super interesting. There are a few different invariants. The first one is that this addition down here, where we add two, doesn't overflow, right? That's something that probably we know, otherwise the code is broken at least. But the compiler isn't aware that this won't overflow. Another invariant is that as.length is something that's meaningful. Like from what we can see here, we can't actually say that as.length isn't infinite. And if it is infinite, then this will be an infinite loop, which is also probably not what we meant. It also shows coupling, because we can actually say something about this code, about the code we can't see from what we can see here. For instance, we can probably say what the type of AS is, which is interesting. So in this case, AS is probably an array, I would guess. It's also probably a numerical array of some sort. We can even say something about the language it's written in, because it has this uppercase L for length, which is quite uncommon. It's probably the only one I know is C#. So probably this is some C# code. To contrast that to another way of writing the same thing, we could do something like as.map and then have this thing. This code down here has no coupling. We can't say anything about AS except it's probably a collection or something that has a map method of some sort. It still has the invariant that it doesn't overflow that was there before. But it has lower coupling and one fewer invariants. The reason coupling and invariants are important is that we have to keep them in our heads while we're coding, right? If we forget what sort of assumed about the code or what the previous developer knew, then we make mistakes and then bugs get into the code. So we have to keep track of all of the couplings, all of the invariants, and that's just, we have limited capacity for that while also solving a problem. So that's why all of software architecture is about reducing the cognitive load of working with a code base. Cool. I'm going to use a running example of code so that we can see the same piece of code evolve over time or throughout the talk. And I've chosen a simple stack implementation because it's compact and it shows the things that I like to show. I'm using a language that's sort of like Java because Java is a very common language, but it's not exactly Java. I'm skipping the access modifiers and stuff to just have some space on the slide. I'm choosing to implement it using like a node class, so an internal node, so that we don't have any bounds, right? We can have an infinite number of these nodes. Again, except for the infrastructure thing, it might run out of memory, all of that stuff. And then we have the simple stack here, where we have just a push, a peak, and a pop, which are implemented in the way that we expect. Some interesting things about this. First of all, pop only returns something, only modifies, it doesn't also return something, and that makes it a lot simpler to reason about. It's generally good advice to separate the mutators from the accessors, just so we have a clean interface. It's also generic, so it can have any type of element in it, and we can reuse it. And we use null to represent the empty stack. So as you can see from the fact that it can either be null or a node, and a node has an element. Cool. So this example is interesting because it has some of the. It illustrates the most common problems that I see in object-oriented code bases normally. The first one is null pointer errors, and here we have two places where they can happen. They can happen at the peak and at the pop. So that means because we have a possible error, we also have an implied invariant. The invariant here is top cannot be null when we call peak and pop, which also is a fairly simple invariant for a stack implementation, at least it's very common. Another potential issue comes from the fact that we have side effects. In this case, we have two specific assignments here to the top element. And side effects are interesting because they're not always undesirable, but they might be, and at least they can be dangerous. To see why they can be dangerous, imagine we have this stack being used with two different threads here, T1 and T2. T1 just pushes till elements and then pops them again. But T2, at some point in the middle, will go in and then take one off and put a 5 instead, right? Which, for the most part, this will succeed, but sometimes T2 will jump in there while the stack is actually empty, and then the program will crash because they're sharing the same stack, the same memory. This doesn't have to come from threads. It can also come from two separate systems that are far away from each other in the code base, where one of them modifies a stack that's also used somewhere else in the code. And then if we make a bug over in the UI system, it might be reported or it might be influenced in the finance system, and that makes it very difficult to debug systems like this. So side effects, the invariant caused by side effects is that they encourage non-local effects. We can have effects that are arbitrarily far away from each other. And if that's what we want, of course, that's great. If it's not what we want, that might make it dangerous. We also have another actually potential for this, which comes from the fact that the node class is entirely mutable. So anyone can do anything to this so long as they have access to it. The common solution in this case, at least, would be to make node an internal class to the stack, so only from inside the stack can you reach it, sort of encapsulating it and thereby limiting the scope of where you can change it. But that still means that 6 months after I've implemented this stack, if I go back and make some changes and I break the invariant of the node, then again we have bugs in the code. We also have the final potential problem here is the fact that we have class level generics. In this case, it's an instance of something called early binding, and I'll get back to that a little bit later. But the invariant, at least, is that once we instantiate this, the type will never change, right? Because it can't change. That's how generics work in this case. The reason that's a problem is we might want to implement something like a map method. For example, consider we have a stack with these elements, then we might want to implement a method that goes through and multiplies each of them by 2, and then we have this stack as an output. If we now try to go and call this same initial stack with divide by 2 instead and give me the number as a floating point, we'll have a type error. That's not possible because it can only store ints at the moment. So that's the thing. And the reason that's a problem here, I've implemented it, or at least written the obvious way of writing map. We have this assignment down here at head, the one I've made red. I hope red is visible because I've tried to highlight the important things with red. So the assignment down there means that the function, the input function here is forced to have the same input type and output type. So T and T at the top. And that's not what we want. We want something that can transform these to anything, like objects or whatever. We might want to do crazy things. So I've come up with 6 principles that are going to fix all of these issues and improve the code a whole lot. And they're all driven by the compiler, which is super cool. The first one is to use immutability. In a lot of languages like Java and TypeScript and other languages, it's fairly straightforward to make something immutable because we can add the keyword final. This is very difficult to read. If it's not important, it's grayed out. So just, although I guess it's a little bit important. So we add final to all of the fields. In this case, both in the node and in the top or in the stack. And that means we now have a bunch of errors in the code. Is it sort of visible? Yeah, but I can't go and change like 90 slides. I'm sorry. Well, we have some issues because we have 2 assignments now, and these variables are made final, so we're not allowed to assign to them anymore. The solution here is to go and so the compiler will tell us these are errors, right? We don't have to look for these ourselves. Once we've made them final, the compiler will be like, here are all the places you can't change. Then the solution is to go and actually wrap them in new stacks every time we wanted to make a modification and then return that instead. So we change all the void functions to be stack functions instead. And then now this works again. Except we still have an assignment in the map function. This assignment is now illegal. And if we try to fix that, we're going to have to juggle a lot with these different values because we are sort of changing the type of the node. And so we need to move both all of the tail elements and the current element at the same time. And there are sort of 2 ways to do this. There is the easy way and the hard way. The reason this can be hard is that we have this definition of node that is recursive. It refers to itself in tail. And so that means if we're trying to do all of this with loops, we'll have a really hard time trying to make that sort of work. But if we're trying to go through it with recursion, that's a lot easier because the data type is recursive. So when you have recursive data, it makes sense to go through it with recursion, and that's the second principle. Use recursion. And I just want to share one of my pet peeves with you guys. I think a lot of people know what recursion is, and a lot of people know this sort of meme over here. In order to understand recursion, you must first understand recursion. But the thing is, I have a different take on recursion than I think most people present it. And so I hope I can still add a little bit of new stuff by explaining how I see it. First of all, recursion has 2 rules. The first one is you have to handle all of the cases as either a base case or a recursive step. That sort of makes sense. But the second rule is it has to have at least 1 base case. Otherwise, it's not recursion. It's something else. It's called co-recursion. I'm not going to talk about it here. But the thing is, that means this over here is not a valid meme because it has no base cases, right? So really, it doesn't work at all. But these 2 rules are actually going to take us through. If we want to just make a function that does the mapping, like we had before, as a recursive function, we can actually just go through the rules and sort of extrapolate how it should look without thinking, which is the important thing, right? Because we want to take stuff out of our brains while we're coding. The first thing we need to consider is what should the type be of the thing we're trying to implement? Well, it should take a function that can take something from T to B, and then it should take the current stack, which is a node of type T, and then it should return something that's a stack of type B. So when we have that, we can say, what are the cases we have? Well, we have 2 cases. We have null and the node. Those are the 2 possible values. And node is the recursive one. So already there's a hint. That means null must be a base case. And we can just input the only value we have, which is return null. Once we know that node is the recursive step, we also know that we need a recursive call somewhere in the node code. So that can go just there. To satisfy the types that we've put in, we have to instantiate a new node. Otherwise, we have nothing. And the only thing that can go in that last spot is f.apply head. And so without thinking at all, just following what the compiler is asking us to do, we can actually only have this correct implementation of how that looks. And the only thing we need to replace this old function is to have a wrapper function that just makes the interface a little bit nicer and hides the fact that we have an extra argument on our recursive version. The helper over there has two arguments and we only want one. So from doing that, we've actually fixed our typing issue. Now it says B in all the right places, and we actually have the map function that we wanted to have in the beginning. And I just want to underline, what are the advantages we get from using recursion here? The thing is, we barely had to think while we were implementing it, because the types were sort of motivating what we had to do. At each step, it was like, there's only really one thing to do, and so we just follow what it's telling us to do. The second thing is that we can reason about each of the cases separately from each other. So there's a lower coupling, so to say, between the things. If we were trying to do the same thing with loops, all of the things would sort of interact with each other all of the time. But here, we could say, well, null has to do this, and the other case has to do this, and forget about everything around it, which allows us to sort of eat an elephant in small bites, so to speak. And this is not a coincidence that these things happen and we get these things out of this. And I really just want to share with you some of my passions for this stuff. And if the theory stuff and like very theoretical stuff isn't quite your cup of tea, feel free to check your email now. While the slides are blue, it's going to be about the very theoretical stuff. The thing is, like 100 years ago, this guy invented something really, really useful, right? He invented numbers, and it was a total game changer. Of course, people have been using numbers before then, but the thing is, this guy's numbers were a little bit different in a very important way, because we called them piano numbers. I don't know if he called them that. That would have been a little bit selfish. But he defined them as a number being either zero, or it can be the successor of another number. And the reason that's important is that he also defined, he also had a statement to go with these things. And he said, if you can prove that something is true for zero, and you can prove that if it's true for one number, it's also true for the next number, then it's true for everything, right? It's true for all the, even ones you haven't checked, and even ones nobody has ever checked or even ever thought of, like all of the numbers are now under this property, which is amazing. And it's so powerful. It's a cornerstone of mathematics called induction, structural induction to be precise. And being mathematicians, of course, they had to find a very complicated way to write it, so they write it like this, but it really says the same thing, and it's not important what this says. The thing is, if I, as a programmer, want to implement a function to do something a number of times and then give me back the result, I would need to know three things, right? So here, I just want the result back, some generic result, I don't know what it is, but I need to know three things. What is the starting point? What to do at each step? And how many times do you want me to do it? Right? These are the three things I need to know to do something. And this looks a little bit familiar. At least it does to me. I can make it even more visible what this sort of represents, right? Because we have all of the same elements, although not quite in the same order. We write the return value at the start in a lot of languages. But if the return goes at the end, then this is literally the same thing. So really, induction is the type that recursion would have if we just wrote up the type, which is just an incredible fact. That means that while we are coding in a recursive way, our compiler constructs a proof behind our backs that all of the types work and all of the things are correct. And that's immensely powerful. We can still have mistakes, but we're trying to hit the bullseye of correct code. And where before we could make both small and big mistakes, with the compiler actually proving something, it's now a big green thing. Difficult colors. We can't make small mistakes anymore because the compiler will detect them now. So we can only make really big mistakes or no mistakes at all, or get compile errors, of course, until we get it correct. And luckily, it's less likely that we'll make big mistakes because most people will be like, oh, wait, what am I doing at all? And then stop and reassess what direction they're going. So that means we already have eliminated a bunch of errors from this. Okay, that was like a lot of the theory part. There's only a little bit more theory later. But let's get back to the next principle. Prefer later binding. That's the thing I promised I would just reiterate at the start of the thing. The thing is, in this code, we have this we now have this node element and this other variable that keeps a node element, but node is entirely immutable, so there's really no point in encapsulating it anymore. There's no danger in exposing node directly. So we just remove the field and then have the the regular node just be what it wants to be all the time. And that also means that we can now go and look at these different places where we use stack. We obviously don't have stack anymore. Now they need to be node because we're exposing the node. And that also means we need to add the argument because before it was a field, now it's a parameter. So we just moved something from the state to be a parameter instead. Everywhere. And now that we've done that, this T that the stack has, oh, I can't go away from the camera. This T that the stack has isn't binding any data. It's not important. So we can actually just postpone it and put it on each of the methods instead. And now this is not so much a stack as it is just a class of utilities to work with a stack. So we also rename it because it's a little bit nicer. But this is really cool because now where we before had to make a stack for integers and a stack for floating point and a stack for objects, we can use this stack utils for any type. It doesn't care. And all of the methods just work. They can even be static if we want to save memory for some reason. And it's a really powerful technique. The later we lock in our decisions, the more reusable the code becomes. And that's general. That doesn't only apply to like generics. It also applies to other things. In this case, we have like two versions of a sorting algorithm, and then we have a master method to sort of select which algorithm you want to run for, I don't know, testing purposes or whatever. But in this case, if I want to change this, I need to actually go and change the code. We can contrast it to using instead something like an interface and then have different classes implementing that same interface that then call the same code, right? It still calls quicksort, it still calls insertion sort. But the thing is, if I want to change this code, I need to go into the code, change the code, recompile it, and redeploy it to make the change. Whereas this code over here, I can go and add a new class, compile it separately from the other code, and then just as long as the code has a way of loading in new code, I can just plug it in while it's still running. I don't need to touch any of these things. So that means we can have like change by addition instead, which is also super nice. Cool. Getting back to the stack, we have an issue now. We still can have null pointer exceptions because we still use null to represent an empty stack, and it's in these cases, in this case. So there's a very simple solution for this. Don't use null. Unfortunately, a lot of languages don't support you disabling null entirely, but we can. There is a solution that we can use, and then just if we're very vigilant and if we're very, very good with our other code hygiene, we should be able to eliminate them, checking third-party things and stuff. The solution is to use something called null object pattern, where we instead make a new class called empty to represent an empty stack instead of null, and then we make an interface. And then we have both the node class and the empty representing class implement that new stack. That also means, of course, that node is no longer just pointing to a node, it's pointing to something that can also be empty. Apart from the fact that we don't get these, we can also specify now at each place whether we want a stack that's possibly null or definitely not null. Because whenever we say node, we know that it is not empty, right? It can only be something. So now we can't have null pointer exceptions. We have so precise types that we can say exactly what we want as our input. And then the compiler will help us figure out if someone's calling it wrong or prevent them from. So now there are no longer null pointer exceptions. We do have a new error that the compiler is informing us. At any point in this, the compiler is telling us what to do next. It's not like we have to do a lot of thinking. It's saying that one over there doesn't really work because we have a null check and we don't use null anymore. So obviously that's never going to trigger. In fact, we wanted to check if something is an instance of the empty class. And Java programmers will be quick to suggest something like instance of, but that breaks the next principle we're going to go into. Don't use runtime types. The thing is, runtime types are sort of like, they're not some part of the compiler, right? It doesn't know anything about them. So it's sort of telling the compiler to back off, but it's a really powerful tool. I've been working on this code to compiler dictionary to just explain to people what they're actually saying to the compiler when they put these things in their code. The first one is if you put a cast, you're just telling it, I know what the type is, you don't. Like, I know better than you. And it's literally a type checker. Like, that's its job. And it spent 40 years becoming one or something. You also have something like instance of where it's like, I don't know, we'll just check it at runtime. We'll just see. Maybe it's an instance of this thing. It's not a very, very codey thing to put in there. We have dynamic types where it's like, I don't care, so you shouldn't either. Just let it be, let me do whatever I want. And finally, the worst one is like reflection, where it's like, I can literally do your job, right? all of these are very rude. Don't do this with your compiler. It's like you're saying to the compiler, stand back, I got this. And then, you know, the compiler will stand back and it will happily watch you yeet yourself off of a cliff of, somehow, which is super uncomfortable. So the reason, like, this is super important, again, a little bit of theory, is that we have these very strong type systems. Type systems have two properties that we actually want of them. They can be sound, which means if there are no type errors on compile time, then there are not going to be any runtime errors, which is very nice. They can also be decidable, meaning they don't run forever. That's cool of a compiler to stop eventually. At least it sucks when it doesn't. Unfortunately, all of the languages that we tend to use are neither of these two, but they're close enough. We can sort of just pretend that they are. And that means that we have this thing, if a type system is sound, we don't need the runtime types. There's actually no reason they're in there. And in fact, Java was born without instance of, because it is not necessary for its type system at all. And that means we can sort of simulate that if we don't use the runtime types, we get what's called theorems for free. We get a lot of things being true about our code and about working with the code that we can sort of rely on, both in a very, very theoretical way. There's a paper there, but I won't go into Reynolds abstraction theorem for polymorphic lambda calculus right now. But we also get it in a very practical way in rules like this one. If we delete a declaration and the compiler doesn't complain about it, then that code was unused. That's true if you don't use runtime types. Of course, if you use runtime types, you don't know. Like, anything might happen. And in fact, I was with a customer once helping to refactor the code base. And I start always by asking, do you use cast? Do you use instance of? Do you use these runtime types? Do you have reflection? And they say, no. We know from university that's bad. We're not going to do it. I'm like, OK, that's good. So after a while of refactoring, we got to this nasty code deep in their code base where it had a bunch of declarations. I'm like, are these even used? And they're like, we don't know. We don't remember this code. And I'm like, try deleting them and see if the compiler complains. And we deleted them. The compiler was fine. And we continued coding until we reached another part of the code where it turned out they were using a tool, something with AutoMapper or something, where it would go and actually fetch from the declaration what the type, what the variables were. And that meant we couldn't rely on anything. We had to go back and undo all of the deletion we've been doing because they used reflection in a library. So we get these things if we don't rely on the runtime types at all. And also, while we're talking about runtime types and static types, I also need to mention the broccoli of programming, exceptions. Everybody hates them. Everybody knows they're good for you. What are we going to do? My advice is always use checked exceptions instead of unchecked exceptions, at least, of course, for the same reason that I'm saying that the types are important everywhere else. This is also a way that So now, because we're using visitor pattern. And the thing is, in doing so, we actually have this thing that this ST down here actually pointed to this one, which would have caused an infinite recursion. In fact, all of the implementations of map we've seen had infinite loops in them, and I'm betting nobody noticed, which is super, super unfortunate. That's also a very common problem in code, in object-oriented code bases. But this one over here shadows the outer ST, so it will actually work. So this is the first version that actually works of all of the code. And the thing is, we encountered a wild design pattern. In fact, and I'm talking about strategy pattern. In fact, it has a tendency to pop up in a lot of places, and it's sort of been lurking all throughout this presentation. In that, in the introduction that I did when I introduced the example, there was a strategy pattern hiding up there. When we talked about piano numbers, there was a strategy pattern there. Later binding had one over there with the algorithms. We had one for null object pattern. It's literally a strategy pattern. Visitor pattern also has one. Ooh, this animated, not good. Yeah, but it's down there. And the reason that this strategy pattern emerges everywhere is because it's sort of fundamental for everything we've been talking about. And I'd like to just show you how it emerges, like, because in the original blue book of handed to us by the Gang of Four, it's sort of a here you write up, draw your entire design as a UML diagram and then spot where all of the variation points are going to be. And it's like, that's not what happens in the real world at all. Instead, I like to see strategy pattern as something that emerges when you actually unify two pieces of code that are similar. In this case, I have a method for finding the maximum number of an array and also to sum all of the numbers in an array. And these are pretty similar, so we might want to unify them. The first step is to go and pick out all of the things that are different, right? One step first. First, we make them a little bit more similar by, instead of having the addition and the if, we actually push it into just say, have one equals and then a something in there. So now we can go and pick out everything that's different. And so we'll end up with these pieces of code. All of that is the equal stuff, and these two are also equal. So we only need to continue with one of them. We just pick whatever. Now we just need to fill all of these holes, and then we have our implementation. The first thing is the variable, and that's very easy to fill. We just put something like result or some variable name. The second thing is we need to know what the starting thing is, so we just add that as a parameter. Whenever we don't know what to add, we can just put it as a parameter. And then we have the big hole in the middle, which is the hardest one to fill. So we can just go and add a new interface to say, I don't know what's going to run here, but you can just hand it to me and then add a new parameter as we did before. So here, just something that takes two numbers that does something with it. And now the only thing we need to fill in is the name of the thing. And in a lot of languages, this is called reduce. It is also called fold or whatever. It has a lot of names. Naming is, of course, notoriously difficult, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Now we can go and we can actually take the maximum function that we had at the beginning and implement it using this new reduce thing. So we just call reduce with the red value from our input and then the function that we're using down there as the maximum operator. And the same we can do with the sum. We just call reduce but with zero and then the addition down there. And here we have it. The operator thing that we made where we didn't know what to put is a strategy pattern. It just appears from unifying similar code. And you can unify any code by just doing these same things, right? This one, as soon as you have that anywhere, it's a strategy pattern. And it's super powerful. It's like, that's one of the things that make all of what we talked about possible. So if you take just one thing away, first of all, the talk has literally six things in the description, so it's unfortunate if you can only remember one. But if you can, it should be how powerful strategy pattern is, because it is amazingly powerful. And if you can have an extra thing, it should be how powerful the compiler is. Because when you have the strategy pattern managing the coupling, and you have the compiler eliminating the invariants, these two together can save any code base. Like, they can find almost all of the issues that are going to be in there, even without any testing or running the code at all. At university, when we were studying programming languages, we had sort of a joke where we said, well, exceptions are for people who actually run their code. We never do that. We just type it, and then it's probably good. Deploy it, ship it. These have been the six principles that we've been using to actually unlock the power of strategy pattern and of the compiler. It's been use immutability, field should be in, final or read-only. Use recursion to match the data, recursive function. Prefer later binding, later decisions give us more reusability. We have don't use null, and instead use null object pattern. And don't use runtime types, so no cast, no instance of, no dynamic, no reflection. And use algebraic data types instead, something like visitor pattern. And all of these have been compiler driven. Like, we never have to make any of the decisions ourselves, basically. The compiler tells us where the errors are, where we need to go and fix these things. And each of them have, literally, you can look up the solution. So this is much more likely to succeed for even for novices that are just following blind rules without much understanding. This will work, whereas testing tend to not. Thank you very much for your time.
Is there anyone who got questions? We have two.
So what's your take on the choice of the use of functional programming languages?
Can you speak a little bit louder?
Yeah, that it seems that a lot of these principles are kind of like very much baked in into functional programming languages.
Yes.
So what's your take on that? And what's your take on discipline? No, because I feel that, you know, if you can cheat, one will cheat eventually, no? Like, if like there's not like a strong enforcement for following certain rules, like, you will cheat, like one, I will cheat, no? Like someone else will cheat, no? Like someone else will not follow this, no? Whereas like, where, like there's like other kind of like, well, there's languages where these principles are very much baked into the language itself, no?
Yeah.
And like also kind of like the like, would you consider convenient to also learn, would you consider convenient to learn functional programming languages as an object oriented? I feel also that the use of functional programming languages has changed the way I think about the state and mutability in object oriented.
Yes. So I'll just recap what I think the question is, because it's a little bit hard to hear. So you're asking whether how this relates to functional languages and whether I would recommend getting into functional programming if you're already an OO. Is that correct?
Yeah, and also discipline, not like how much discipline takes part in following.
Okay. So, this is, of course, very closely related to functional programming, and the principles are stolen directly from functional programming, because functional programs tend to have fewer bugs. So that's sort of the secret to this whole thing. But the other thing that once you've been in the industry or you've met people and you've talked to a lot of developers, you'll notice that the second you say functional programming, they stop listening unless they already know everything you're going to say. So it's very difficult to talk to other people. Like, it's very segregated right now with the functional programmers and the OO. So my sort of life mission in a way has been to sort of help OO programmers get all of the same advantages that FP gives you, but without ever scaring them off. And so all of these things apply equally to both paradigms. But as you say, it's more natural to do some of these things in a functional setting, but it is very hard to go from OO directly to FP. If you don't understand these principles, you are going to have to learn both the new paradigm, the new syntax, the new standard library, and like change your entire way of thinking. And that just isn't how humans are built. So what I'm trying to do is bridge that gap by making smaller and smaller steps so you can choose the appropriate tool for the appropriate task. And being a former programming language researcher, I'm language agnostic. I just switch between them very fluently where something makes more sense. So I think if you are an object-oriented programmer now, depending on how young you are, if you're in your early 20s, I still think you should learn a functional programming language. In fact, I think you should learn multiple different paradigms. And in the olden days, people like to say that you should learn one new language a year. I think it's a pragmatic programmer says one language a year. I think that's not going to help a lot of people, because there are so many frameworks now that we also need to learn, that probably learning a new technology is a better piece of advice. But also because a lot of languages are very closely related. Like if you know Java and then learn C#, that will take you 2 hours. And it's like you're done for the year. It's sort of, but it also hasn't contributed anything to the way that you think. So learning a new paradigm is much more helpful if you're young. If you're sort of in an established career, I think still sticking to the principles instead and learning, mastering your craft will probably be better, effort better spent than learning a completely new paradigm, just because of the effort it is to go up that steep learning curve. Yeah.
Like in the role of discipline, how would you tackle that? Like pull request preview, like reviews, like, you know, like how do you deal with, you know, like this need of like enforcing a certain discipline?
Yeah, I don't like pull requests because they're unrecommended by all of the research we have on software practices, because they tend to put in a blocker into your pipeline, and you want code going as streamlined through your pipeline as possible. So don't like pull requests, at least not when they are asynchronous. I love synchronous pull requests when you have two people looking at the same code at the same time, right? Or even the whole team. When you're working as a team and staying intact, learning these things becomes possible. If you have one programmer and you teach him, here are six new principles, they're really cool, they're gonna do amazing for you with no work at all, then immediately when they see the first ticket of real work they're gonna work on, they fill up their capacity with that ticket and then they continue. So you can't build new habits when you have someone already doing work. And so I always, when I work with team, enforce pair programming and mob programming at least one day a week, because then they can actually build new habits and they can start doing things. And something like teaching people to commit more often or smaller or new messages, it's impossible if you just tell them why it's important. They will agree with you for an hour and a half and then they'll go and do the same thing they did yesterday. So you're not gonna change anything. So pair programming and mob programming, that's how you build new habits.
Thanks for all the very nice talk. So this was a lot of Java-focused code. And I was wondering, do you also have criticisms for more recent languages? Because especially languages like Rust have addressed all of these concerns, but there's probably something that maybe you say, okay, this is still not quite right.
What do you mean not recent? Java's from like the 90s. Or something. I could have done this in Fortran. So the question, just to recap it, is whether newer languages are better on some of these things. And certainly Rust is like a prime example of that, and TypeScript as well. They have amazingly cool type systems that are new and revolutionary and can do things that no other language really can. They were both included, actually, in the none of the new languages have it either. Unfortunately, they are neither sound nor decidable. I think Rust should be the de facto standard for embedded code because it is both faster and it has the borrowing type system, which eliminates a whole bunch of especially multi-threading issues and stuff like that. I think Rust is really cool. I tried implementing my own Rust because I thought it was an interesting case study, but I didn't get very far. It's very complicated. I also think with TypeScript's union intersection types, you can also encode even more information into your compiler. The more you can teach the compiler about your code, the better it can help you. So I think modern languages are getting better at that, especially also with the more rise of functional code embedded into it. So you have arrow functions in a lot of languages, and that's a prerequisite to do most of this stuff in some way. And so as long as if you have legacy systems, they're gonna have something like instance of or reflection, and everything's gonna be out the window. Newer languages, I think, are better at not making it so easy to break at least the compiler. I'm hoping we're moving to a better place. There's also a lot of rise in the new languages that come out that have functional, either cores or entirely functional. So I think it is getting better, but I still think we have probably 15, 20 years of OO, I'm guessing.
All right, thank you to Christian for this talk. If you have more questions, he is probably available for some time. Thank you for a talk about code quality.